Her writing explores the roots of her own life, a Czechoslovakian immigrant and Catholic American history. Those roots have made her attentive to what forms a person's perspectives, one's habits, and spirituality. The gift of her writing is that while it offers her life, it turns the reader's thoughts inward to a more personal set of roots and formations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We'll look with Patricia Hampel at those turnings inward on this edition of Conversations. Welcome, Patricia. Thanks for joining
Hello.
Us.
Hello. It's a joy to be here.
You have in your latest book called Virgin Time some words I want to reflect back at you and then ask you about. It's about roots. It's about looking inward. You say, looking for our roots, we say, but our roots are buried. They're supposed to be. And the past isn't alive, only our urgency is. Yeah, if you want to read from there, that's great. And then talk to me about what that means to you.
Maybe this urgency is the past, I write in the first chapter, the only juice still spurting from the source that made us. It must be this urgency, a peculiar form of desire that makes us zoom around, looking for what time has put back in its breast pocket. And I'd said a little bit earlier, people like me, fused by fascination to their past, find themselves taking planes to distant places, boarding with an urgency that suggests a family emergency is calling us home. And I do think that we now know what we're talking about when we say somebody is looking for his or her roots. When you really think about that, that's a very odd thing to be looking for. You should be looking for your blossom or your fruit, yeah, but not your roots. Those things are supposed to be covered up. And yet I think it's an inevitable American thing to do, maybe North American thing to do.
Why?
Because so many of us come from somewhere else in our background, if not otherwise. So that there are certain stories that various cultures can't get enough of, and it depends on the culture what the story is. And our culture can't get enough of the immigrant story, mm-hmm, because we believe that if you tell me your family immigrant story, I will then be able to meditate upon my immigrant story. And I've had the experience, which is really very gratifying but surprising to me, that when I read a portion of another of my memoirs called Romantic Education, which is about my Czech background, and I read about my grandmother's garden, I now am used to this experience. After the reading, someone will come up to me and say, you know, I really loved that part about your grandmother's garden. It was just great. And I've come to know that at that moment, that's the last time we will hear anything about my grandmother. From then on, it belongs to that person's grandmother.
Yes.
And I love that. And I think until that had happened to me, I didn't understand that service of literature that it performs for people. I mean, I had it done for me as a reader a million times, but I didn't understand how wonderful the economy of literature is, that it really, you do hand over your material, your wealth, and it turns out the other person is able to make it into his or her gold. It's a very lovely arrangement, really.
And don't you think that's only if you are truly digging deep in your own garden?
Well, I think sometimes you don't know what your own gold is, because I can distinctly remember writing the passage or the section I'm talking about my grandmother's garden. It was the first scene I wrote, and it now is somewhere in the middle of the book. I don't even quite know where it is, but mm-hmm, I wrote it as a separate little thing. And I wrote it just out of love for that memory of her garden. And I remember thinking when I wrote it, well, you know, nobody'd be interested in this. It's just, but I wanted to do it. But when I was done writing it, I did know that it was alive. I didn't know if it was good, bad, or indifferent, but I knew that it had some life. And so it really wasn't until, you know, I sent that shuttlecock over the net, and it wasn't until a reader sent it back to me with the message, yes, I got it, you know, and I can send it back to you with my attachment on it.
I want to ask you about this notion of our immigrant status giving us such a deep fascination with roots rather than, as you say, with blossoms or fruit. Is it that we don't have our past lying around us? If your people had stayed in Czechoslovakia, for example, the history of 1,000 years would have been next door, rather than in a book, rather than in a library. is it that you don't have your roots visible that compels you to return to Czechoslovakia, both in a writerly sense and in a traveler's sense?
Well, I think that roots are not as personal as we always think they are. When I went to Czechoslovakia in 1975 for the first time, I had, as many people do, the name of my grandmother's village on a piece of paper. I couldn't even pronounce it, but I had it in my hand. And I remember at a certain point in Prague, I was so blown away by Prague and what it was like there that I balled up that piece of paper and threw it away, because I understood I wasn't looking for my grandmother anymore. I was looking for something, in a sense, more impersonal, even anonymous, which had to do with that whole cultural, historical world. Now, I think the other thing we have to remember is that when people came over here in the great immigration of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, they really thought they were saying goodbye forever. And, in fact, they were in most cases. Certainly my grandmother never went back. The dislocations of the century, the lack of mobility that such people had, all of these things produced a genuine break in connection. What that meant was they must not have illusions about going back. They needed to let it go. They needed to forget. Oftentimes there was a lot of shame also. We all know the stories about the kids who didn't want to speak, you name it, Italian, German, Czech, Hungarian at home, because they only spoke it at home, but with some shame, but they didn't want it to be spoken outside of the home because they wanted to be American. Okay, that takes care of the first and second generation. Then you get to third generation person like me, and all of a sudden there is both the appetite and I would even say the leisure, mental leisure. Mm-hmm. There is the curiosity and all of that ability to have curiosity about something that suddenly is not shameful so much, is not fearful, but is fascinating. So it's almost like just as it goes off the horizon and cannot be touched anymore, as it's entering an imaginative realm, it's grabbed back. And that's what we call our roots. But of course, it's really an imaginative construct.
Yes.
In the end.
Has your exploration given you anything of your Czechness that was not there before?
Well, I think it's significant that I don't speak Czech. I think language is the real resonance of a culture. And if you don't speak the language, that means there's some way in which you aren't of it. Mm-hmm. So I certainly wouldn't be able to claim any kind of deep immersion. On the other hand, I feel a connection. I have been to Prague, but I've been to what was Czechoslovakia, what is now the Czech Republic, many times. I'm going back for a Fulbright Fellowship in April of 95. I'll be there through the summer. And I will study Czech at that time. Of course, I won't come back speaking it. I'll come back just a pathetic, baby with it. But I think in the end, I came back with a story, a version, but I certainly wouldn't claim that I am a representative of Czech culture in some way now.
Right, right. Let me ask you the other side of that question. Did you come back with any sense of your Americanness that was new or renewed by having gone to this other place that is also of you?
Absolutely. I went to Czechoslovakia for the first time in the spring of 1975. What feels like, it's a generation ago. It almost feels like a lifetime ago. Backpack, no money, no credit card, more to the point. Very much, the solo traveler going behind the Iron Curtain. And it was. I had some scary Iron Curtain moments. I was the only American I met there the whole time. Today, of course, there are 30,000 Americans living in Prague, estimated, living there, not traveling there, living there. So the Vietnam War was still on. While I was in Prague, the troops left Vietnam in May of 75. I was very much an anti-war protester. All the predictable things about a 60s generation person were on my list, you know, feminist. I like to think of myself as a radical. My boyfriend went to prison for the draft, all and other friends as well. So to travel to the across the other side, you know, down the rabbit hole, through the other side of the mirror, was for me a very American thing to do.
Yes.
Precisely because where I was going wasn't America. And what I saw there, of course, was that everything we sort of had right, they had wrong. And everything they had right, we had wrong. If I would speak to them about individual liberties and freedom of the press, they would ask me who was paying for my health care and whether if I had a child, I would get leave time to take care of that child. So that a lot of the social service things that we are still fighting about here in this country, they had. And by the way, they're losing them now.
Because of this change.
Because of this change that they're undergoing. So it was really a rather pure act to go across that space, to go. I don't think I've ever experienced a border as absolute and profound, and probably never will again, as that one between Western Europe and the Czech Republic and Czechoslovakia, as it was then.
Will you read for us from this first book?
I think it might be interesting for you to hear what my first view of Prague was when I was in my late 20s, I guess it was. And I had not been to Europe before. I had dreamed of Europe. And I sort of had to remember that when you went to Europe, they were going to have cars, because my view of Europe was from 19th century novels, of course. And I sort of had this very English major 19th century novel reading view. So I got on the train and went from London to Prague. I was alone and came into Prague at dusk. And this is what I saw. Prague stopped my tourism flat. The weight of its history and the beauty of its architecture came to me first as an awareness of dirt, a sort of ancient grime I had never seen before. It bewitched me, that dirt, caught in the corners of Baroque moldings and decorative cornices, and especially I loved the dusty filth of the long, grave windows. At sunset, when the light flared against the oblongs and caused them to look gilded, I had arrived in a river city just as I had left one in St. Paul. But the difference. On the right bank of the Vltava, in German the Moldau, the buildings were old to me. Some of them were truly old, churches and wine cellars and squares dating from the Middle Ages. But the real look, especially of the residential and shopping areas of Nové Miesto, new city, new since the 14th century, was Art Nouveau, highly decorative, the bohemian version of the Victorian. Across the river in Malastrana, small side, Prague's left bank, the city became most intensely itself, however. It rose baroquely up, villa by villa, palace crushed to palace, gardens crumbling and climbing to the castle that ran like a great crown above it on the bluff. I walked around Prague, hardly caring if I hit the right tourist spots, missing Baroque gems, I suppose, getting lost, leaving the hotel without a map, as if I had no destination. I just walked, stopping at coffee houses, smoking unfiltered cigarettes, and looking out from the blue wreath around me at other deep-drawing smokers. Everyone seemed to have time to sit, to smoke as if smoking were breathing, to stare into the vacancy of private thought, if their thoughts were private. I was in the 30s. I'd finally arrived in my parents' decade, the men's soft caps, the dove colors of Depression pictures, the acquiescence to circumstance, the ruined quality. For the first time, I recognized the truth of beauty, that it is brokenness. It is on its knees. I sat and watched it and smoked. I don't smoke, but I found myself buying cigarettes. Smoked a blue relation between those coffee houses and me. For this sadness turned out to be, to me, beautiful. Or rather, the missing quality of beauty, whatever makes it approachable, became apparent in Prague. I could sit, merely breathing, and be part of it. I was beautiful, at last, and I didn't care, at last. I stumbled through the ancient streets, stopped in the smoke-grimed coffee houses, and added my signature of ash, anonymous and yet entirely satisfied. I had ceased even to be a reverse immigrant. I sought no one, no sign of my family or any ethnic heritage that might be mine. I was simply in the most beautiful place I had ever seen, and it was grimy and sad and broken. I was relieved of some weight, the odd burden of happiness and unblemished joy of the adored child. Or perhaps I was free of beauty itself as an abstract concept. I didn't think about it. I didn't bother to wonder. I sat and smoked. I walked and got lost and didn't care because I couldn't get lost. I hardly understood I was happy. My happiness consisted of encountering sadness. I simply felt accurate.
This is Patricia Hampel. The book she's reading from is called A Romantic Education. It was her first book of prose. Emerged first from Houghton Mifflin in 1981 and then in paper in 1983. A second edition came out just recently in 1992 with a new afterword following the major transformation in Czechoslovakia, a new afterword by the author. A Romantic Education is a journey to Patricia Hampel's Czechoslovakian heritage and, as I can tell from that reading, also to your own awareness as this other person, this American person. Patricia Hampel is our guest on KUAC's Conversations. She is a professor of English at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and makes her home, as she indicated, in St. Paul. I'm Susan McInnes. As you were reading, it interested me that perhaps our immigrant status is, in this country, is the very thing that will get us out of America to see the rest of the world and to see it through these odd cultural eyes that we have.
I'm, at this point, in some ways less worried about Americans getting out and seeing the world. I think we have the colonial power to do that, pretty much, many of us, educated people. I'm a little more concerned about what we're doing with the people who come to us at this point. It's troubling to watch the reception of the new waves of immigrants and to see our impatience, our lack of tolerance, our inability to connect with our own history and our own reminder that couldn't be more intimate. I mean, it's down the bloodlines. We come from people who came elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so they came from across the Atlantic Ocean. And even now, I've been told, by the way, that it's much easier for an illegal immigrant to come through New York or Boston, that those ports are not watched as closely as anybody coming over the southern border or from the west. Mm-hmm. And this says a lot about our problems with race, our problems of xenophobia in general. So I think ideally the lesson of this kind of roots-making would be that you'd understand everybody else has this same issue, problem, identity, inevitable relationship with this country. But in fact, it seems that we don't have that generosity of spirit so often.
Mm-hmm. I would say in response to that, that I think that has always been.
Oh, it has been.
Very American.
Has been,
the
absolutely.
Germans came in, the Scots were rejected, the Irish were rejected.
It's wave upon wave. I mean, on the one hand, we have to understand that the idea we have of immigration, which is that people come here to be free, is ignoring something which I actually talk about in Spillville, my book about Antonin Dvorak coming to America as a visitor, a very, you know, great visitor, not an immigrant, but I talk about immigration there. We have to remember that people really came often because they felt they had no other choice. They were not coming out of idealism, but out of poverty, and that they weren't coming to travel. They were coming out of a sense of banishment, really, Because the truth is, your home should be able to sustain you. You ought to be able to live in Mexico if you're a Mexican. But if that world cannot sustain you, you must go somewhere. And the story of civilization is really not the story of homebodies, finally. It's the story of migrations. And ours is one that, as you say, very clearly we have that as part of our identity, wave upon wave, rejected at home, coming to the place they're supposed to be received, rejected again, and then rejecting those who come in turn. It's something we need to absorb as a reality, in addition to the notion that we have inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. You know?
Yes. Tell me where do I start with this question? You are, at this stage of your writing career, largely a memoirist. You write about your experience and perspective and begin from there. Tell me how the issues that are also in your heart, for example, your concerns about American receptivity to current immigrants, plays for you as you work in a memoir.
I think that particular issue is one that I feel more as a citizen and as someone who has written about and out of immigration, not my own immigration, but the lingering scent of it in my own family life. But the whole issue of memoir, I think, is a vexed one and therefore an interesting one, because in memoir, a person appears to be writing what? Autobiography, my story, the story of my life. What could be more self-absorbed? What could be more egotistical, maybe? What could be more interiorized? But my own experience of memoir has been both in a romantic education, where it was about this political and historical reality of another country, and in Virgin Time, where it was about the reality of a religion, Catholicism, that the memoir encouraged me not only to go inward, but to go outward to issues that had to do with something far larger than me, so that both books seem to me to be not so much about me mm-hmm. as about these subjects in which I am used as the protagonist rather than, certainly not the heroine. I don't think memoirists are people capable of writing themselves as heroes. I think, however, the form requires, as every story does, a protagonist. And so you use yourself in that way or use a part of yourself. But I think it was a surprise for me to discover that. I was an unwilling memoirist. I did not want to write. It never occurred to me to write memoir. When I wrote A Romantic Education, the memoir was not being taught in school, you know, women's autobiography and things like that. These things were not being taught as a genre. There were poems, there were novels, there were short stories, there were essays, and that was it. And I tried to write a biography about my grandmother, who I thought was an interesting character, this Czech immigrant. And it was very dull writing, and it bothered me a great deal that it was so dull. I couldn't figure out why, if she was so interesting, the writing was so bad. And then I wrote the piece I mentioned to you about her garden, and I knew it was alive. And it took me a while to understand that the difference was that the garden one had a consciousness at its heart. It had a protagonist searching, needing the story, and that was, alas, my very own self. And I realized, oh my God, I've got to write in the first person. And as I say, I didn't like that. It went against the grain for me.
What I noticed in Virgin Time, though, was that the protagonist seems to be the one who is carrying the questions. And it's the question that drives things forward as you look at your grandmother, as you bring in Donnie, Sister Madonna, who plays such a large role in Virgin Time, or the other believers, the other Catholics, religious people you run into.
Well, I think, again, we tend to think of genre as there's a thing called fiction, and we understand that. People get to make things up, and things happen, and there are plots. And then there's this thing we call nonfiction. We should probably be very, very wary about anything that has the word non in front of it, because it's really denying the reality of what the thing is. It's like calling everybody a non-Catholic. It just shows how limited your ability to describe the material is. So nonfiction is probably a great umbrella under which lots of different genres are sheltering. And the memoir, which seems to be nonfiction and which has allegiances to some of the things that nonfiction does contract to do for its reader, at the same time shares with fiction a word that doesn't belong to fiction or nonfiction, and that is story. So at some point, the memoirist has to tell a story, and in telling the story must find a character who can carry, as you say, the questions and the ideas that are the bedrock of that story, has to carry it through a human being, and if the first person, guess who that human being is going to be.
Right. You have to move also then between your life. I like what Sister Madonna says a couple of times towards the end of Virgin Time. She says, real life, as we affectionately call it, right?
Yes.
Right. So you have to both write from real life and from something that is in your imagination and from something that is this locus or focus of questions from which things emerge, yes?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting because in Virgin Time, not just in the book, but in the experience of writing it, I came upon a person who asked me this very question, and I ended up writing about it. So I think I'll just read you a little passage here.
Good. Let me find it, and tell me where you are again.
Page 53.
Okay.
Virgin Time consists of travels that I took fairly recently as an adult to various Catholic pilgrimage sites, primarily Assisi in Italy, the home of St. Francis and St. Clare, but some other places, and some monasteries. By the way, the memoir, because it is kind of a flabby genre, just sort of sits around remembering things. In order to sustain itself over the long haul, because after all, it's as fat as a novel, so it has to have some of that rigor that a novel has, doesn't have a plot, what does the memoirist do? Typically, the memoirist goes on a trip, goes on a journey, travels. So travel is the spine, often, of the memoirist's book, the way plot is for the novelist. So I went on a trip. As I went to Prague in Romantic Education, I went to Italy and some of these monasteries in Virgin Time. The first trip was with a bunch of English hikers. They were not religious people, not at all. But the hike was through Umbria, and the trip was to Assisi. And one of the characters, I say character, she was a real person, but I mean she's now mine, so I call her a character, was a woman I call Alma. She was an Australian married to a Brit. She was considerably older than he, a fact he did not let her forget. And a little on the heavy side, another fact he did not let her forget. But Alma, I had a great affection for Alma. I was the only American on the trip, and she was the only non-English person, so she thought she and I were colonials. One day she said to me, "Tell me," Alma said, "do you write from your life or from," she hesitated, trying to fix on another likely source, "or from imagination?" Cecil, her husband, was fascinated by religion, Alma by art. "I've never met an actual writer before," she said. It was dusk. We sat alone at a round table on a tiled terrace cantilevered from the back of our hotel above the broad valley that spread out below the town of Spello. Her big, rough face with its guileless expectation was beginning to disappear with the fading light. I looked away, off to the imprecise landscape below us. We had hiked through that landscape that afternoon. The territory had been steep, pocked with stinging nettles, a hard hike we'd sweated through with much stopping for swigs out of our plastic liter bottles of aqua minerale. Now from the terrace it looked like one easy undulating plain. Off to the side of the terrace, by the iron balcony guard, stood an alabaster statue of a woman, a Venus turned in profile toward the same view that we had. Her stone hair was done up with a wreath of stone leaves, and the contour of her body was visible under the stone chiffon that draped her. She seemed to get whiter as the light faded. We'd been talking about the day's rough hike with the mutual pride of people who are congratulating themselves for having been through something together. We talked and then fell silent and talked again, letting the day go. By the time Alma asked her question, we had entered that anonymous stage of dusk when two people can speak at random without connecting things, without bothering to make eye contact, reaching that extreme of companionship where it is no longer necessary even to address the other person. We spoke to the valley or to the statue, to whatever was still visible. But having no answer, I let her question stand. Alma didn't seem to mind. She picked up her own thread. She was still worried, she said, about something that had happened at Heathrow before they boarded their plane for Rome. "Why is one so bothered by these things?" she said. She had seen a Nigerian woman, very tall, and wearing her native dress, which Alma thought spectacular. A baby was strapped to the woman's back, and she was holding, or trying to hold, several black garbage sacks which were stuffed full. They were obviously her luggage. Alma wanted to help her. Cecil's attitude, "Don't get involved." "That's the English coming out," she says now, as if it were a national or congenital trait, nothing personal to him. In the end, they do help the woman, but only until they come to their own gate. Then the English wins out, and Cecil says to give the luggage back. The woman struggles on with the baby on her back, dragging the plastic sacks across the floor, Alma watching her until she disappears down another endless corridor. "I keep thinking we should have seen her to gate 36, Alma says fretfully. She's lost sleep over this. "Isn't that foolish? I keep wondering, did she make it to gate 36? Did the bags rip open? That sort of thing." It's quite dark now. Even the statue seems to have stopped glowing. Alma's girlish voice starts up again, rushing from her stolid body. "One wants to help, doesn't one? One wants to make a difference. You'd understand that, being a writer." But then Cecil is there before I can correct her. He's saying there is no Bianco. He's gotten her Rosso. He calls her old girl. She turns to me. In the dark, I make out a canny smile, half knowing, half forgiving. It startles me. It's so on Alma. I understand she sees everything and that he is her true love anyway, and I'm not to mention what she said about the beautiful, abandoned Nigerian. It's between her and the goddess. Whether it was from her life or from imagination, the story won't leave her alone. It is entirely of her making. I am just allowed to eavesdrop on the telling, her fellow colonial. "Darling boy," she says, "let's try the Rosso."
All of our stories are then based somewhere between real life, the imagination, and whatever questions move us forward.
I think so.
Yeah.
And we both deny ourselves the joy, but I think also we deny ourselves the hard reality of how we fashion our lives and our versions of reality when we call things nonfiction and don't acknowledge this difficult place of building a reality rather than simply transcribing one. I am not at ease with this. I don't think, "Oh, well, I just make it up. Who cares?" I don't fall for that. I don't like it. I don't think it's responsible or even ethical or even interesting. But I do think that there is a space between the inventions of fiction and that wished-for land of fact where most of us live most of the time and where most of our stories and, in fact, our versions of reality are embedded. And frankly, I think we create them. And this is what we have to acknowledge. I also think the American consciousness is very, very happy, congenial with the first-person voice. Not because we're egotistical, but because we did predicate this nation on individuality, for good or for ill. We are not communal at our base. We're individual. I mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Please, what a strange thing to base a country on. Oh. And our greatest poet and our greatest poem, say it right there, Song of Myself by Walt Whitman. And, of course, Song of the Open Road, another Whitman poem. In other words, we have this in mind that we have to speak in the first person, not because we're egotistical, but because it is the way our imagination works. this brings us, I think, to memoir or to versions of autobiographical writing.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you, my next question to you may not have an answer, and you can just tell me, Susan, this has no answer. But I want to know how you maintain the integrity at the base of this confluence, if I can ask you that. Let me give you a second to chew and reintroduce you to our audience. We've been talking with Patricia Hempel on this edition of Conversations. She teaches at the University of Minnesota. Her educational background is in English and in poetry, a BA from Minnesota in English, an MFA from University of Iowa, the Iowa Writers Workshop in poetry. Her early focus as a writer and driving focus, I think, was poetry. Memoir seems to have overtaken her. Two books of poetry, Woman Before an Aquarium from the University of Pittsburgh Press in 1978, and then Resort, which is a very long poem, Resort and Other Poems, published by Houghton Mifflin in 1983. A Romantic Education, we've mentioned, came out in 1981, republished in 83, came out again in 1992. Spillville, we've only talked about it for half a minute, from Minneapolis Milkweed Editions in 1987, engravings by Stephen Sorman. This is an imaginative study of Dvorak's stay in the Iowa farming village by the same name in the summer of 1893. Her most recent book, Virgin Time, In Search of the Contemplative Life, a Farrar, Straus, and Giroux book, published in 1992. Patricia Hempel, our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at how one's own life becomes literature and then gives to other people. What do you think about that question? And let me give you a parenthetical to go with it. Not too many years ago, a very talented journalist wrote for, I think, the Washington Post, a piece that many people have heard of, few people have read, that showed the trauma of ghetto life on its impact on a ghetto child. We didn't know that the child was a composite, and the Pulitzer Prize was ripped from this woman's hands by a world aghast at what she had done. And yet she was writing about something that's very true, which is the impact of a dreadful life experience on a child. So where's the integrity in pulling all these rivers together?
Yes, I follow that story as I followed the story of Janet Malcolm, who was brought to court, to law, for constructing quotes, and who actually won her case, by the way. In her case, although it was ascertained by the jury that she did fabricate two out of the five, whatever it was, quotes in question, I may have the numbers wrong, but that they were close enough to what this man said all the time anyway, that he could not sue her because, and there was not malice in this. So the legal definition is quite interesting. There has to be malice, and it's very hard to prove. So even at the level of the law, where we're supposed to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, there is an acknowledgement of this shadow area, this gray area. For myself, the fact that the unnamed journalist who won the Pulitzer Prize and had it taken from her was writing in the Washington Post, a newspaper, mm-hmm. working as a journalist, makes the case clear to me and makes it appropriate that she would be stripped of her Pulitzer Prize and makes me wonder what on earth she was thinking of. On the other hand, I have made composite characters in memoirs. If you read A Romantic Education, let's go to Virgin Time because it's clearer there. If you read Virgin Time and I ask you how many times did I go to Italy on the exam question, you would say once. In fact, I went over a period of 5 years, maybe five, maybe six times, I've forgotten, and I used various parts of those trips to create one trip. I also went and didn't use things. Whole summers that I did things, and it turned out that material didn't fit the questions that I ended up thinking were really the important thing. One of the reasons that section about Alma is in here, I then go back after I've spoken about Alma and let her tell her story. I then actually go back and I do kind of answer the question that she asked at the beginning, in which I don't answer to her, but I answer it for the reader, and I say, I write from my life and from imagination. That's what it is to write about or from the past. No doubt I write about the past because I want it to be the past, finally. Not because my own past was awful or unbearable. My unremarkable past in the hothouse of family love, domestic and Midwestern autobiographies flyover. What was remarkable back there was the endlessness of girlhood, the sheer tenacity of my naivete. 25, 30, 35, still a girl, propelled by a fierce ingenue heart, which I wish to cut out, I suppose. Innocence gets vicious over the long run. What I'm saying to the reader there is, I am about the business of making a story for you and for me, and the subject of this story is moving from girlhood to womanhood. And the context is a Catholic girlhood. And I want you to know exactly the kind of genre you're engaged in here. We're talking about the building of conventions, really, around a genre. For example, if you read a chapter in which I am 5 years old, and I say my grandmother said, come in and eat, and I have quotation marks around that. Mm-hmm. And I then say, I don't want to, I want to go out and play. And I have quotation marks around that. Somewhere deep back in the back, danky deep of your mind, you know that I could not remember the exact quote. This is not a direct quote, necessarily. It's the kind of thing that happened habitually, that probably happened, that was probably said that way. We accept that as a convention of the genre, that quotations are used that way. We do not accept it as a convention of journalism that composite figures would be made.
So what do you ask of me as the reader of that new convention?
All right, let's say, I'll give you an exact example. Later on in Virgin Time, again picking up on this plot line I need for the book, I have a trip with a bunch of Franciscans. In fact, there were something like 40 people riding around on that bus. There's no way a narrative can sustain 40 people being described. I picked a handful. And those people are the ones that I followed. Occasionally, a line would come up from somebody else that was absolutely the kind of thing that one of these Franciscans, well, not kind of thing, it was the thing that the Franciscans said, but not one of my characters.
Mm-hmm.
I lifted it from that person and gave it to the right character. A narrative imperative. I'm fuddling, but I don't feel that anyone would think that I was lying as a result. I am constructing, I'm fabricating. There are certain things, for example, like I cannot, for example, in my mind, give my father a line my mother said if I've created those two as distinct characters. That would be ridiculous. It's only done when there's a narrative imperative. Now, the journalist might say, well, I had a narrative imperative. And I say to her, you don't get to have one in that context, because when we open a newspaper, we expect that to be able to look that person up in the telephone book. And if that person doesn't exist, then we can't. When we're reading a memoir, we know we're reading a consciousness. That's a different charge.
This makes good sense to me. So you want from me, from your reader, the knowledge of context, and the knowledge of what is, and the knowledge of your role as the writer, as well as the awareness of the importance of the driving question.
Absolutely. The journalist was looking, my guess is, this woman who got her Pulitzer taken away from her, was looking for an illustration, an example. But she said that she was giving us a life.
Right.
That is a lie. That is not acceptable.
Patricia Hampel with us on Conversations. I want to make a switch with you.
Yes, I think we beat that one down as far as we can go.
No, it's a good question. I think.
Well, it's at the heart of a lot of what's going on about how do you see reality?
Yes. Yeah. Let's move to, I'm very interested in how your consciousness as a poet has impacted other forms in which you're now writing. you write as a poet, you write as a memoirist, you have written a screenplay. I understand you've also written a libretto.
And fiction. I've written short stories.
And fiction, and essays, and short stories. Okay, mm-hmm. So a number of roles. Tell me how the... maybe I shouldn't ask you in this way. I'm interested that I think that poetry gives you a particular ear and a particular eye for white space, for what's understood. And so that's I think what I'm wondering if that drives your writing of other forms in other ways, or if that's inaccurate, what is the driver for you?
I think that rhythm is at the heart of all speech act, you know, all writing, all everything. The cadence, the rhythm of the sentence is as essential to me as the rhythm of the line in poetry. So that I can't imagine thinking of a paragraph as an organizing tool. To me, it's a rhythmic pacing tool. And I'm sure that comes out of my sense of poetry. I think that there is a musicality in the very heart of language that, at least prose, but my prose, the prose I want to write, has to find and has to engage with that. So it's beyond language, right to the beat and the rhythm itself. And also, I guess I'd say that coming out of the tradition of free verse in this century, where the image is so important in poetry, you know, William Carlos Williams saying in the famous dictum, which really has ruled, no ideas but in things. So that we don't have ideas. We're phenomenologists. We look at stuff. We see stuff and we say what it is. And that preeminence of the image certainly is important to me. I fasten on to a detail and I squeeze that lemon for all it's worth. And I believe in its capacity to render meaning and render symbol. If I have that as a strength, I have as a weakness perhaps the ability to sustain action, because of course an image is a static thing, and one of the things I have to work on as a prose writer is to make sure something happens. I'm quite given to having people just sitting in chairs thinking things, and that can be quite passive, and so I have to work against that strain. But the chair will be very vivid to the reader.
Yes.
You know, it's a very good chair, but, you know, do they do anything? Do they ever get out of the chair?
Do you write and then go back and force your characters out of the chair?
Well, I do a lot of rewriting, of course. I mean, I suppose every writer does, but I guess I meant it more as an ongoing growth in my writing, that I recognize that I have an imagistic freeze frame kind of consciousness, a tableau mentality that looks and looks at every part of the picture, but it's not a movie.
Yes.
And one of the things that was great for me in writing a screenplay was keeping things popping right along. And so it was like an immersion test, a crash course in the action writing. Not that it's an action movie, but simply it's a moving picture instead of a framed picture.
The screenplay was written from Spillville and is now where? What's happening?
It's now being shopped about, and a producer, a young independent film producer, bought the option, the rights to make a movie for it, hired me to do the screenplay. God knows why, but anyway, my good luck to do that. Her name is Robin Burke, Robin Burke Productions. She now is, and another writer has now come into the project who has more screenwriting experience to probably correct some of my errors, and I will then go back to work on the shooting script. And what we're waiting for now is for some production company to pick it up and to make it into a movie, and that, of course, is a big if, a big wait. We'll see if it happens. If it does, it will be very exciting, of course, to see something on the silver screen.
Yes. Has it been fun, interesting? Was there any sense of loss in transforming Spillville?
No, because the book is there. I didn't have to do any damage to it, or it wasn't as if I had to cut it up and burn it or something. I had to make a wholly different thing. So the movie is so utterly different from the book. And yet I'm fascinated with the ways in which some of the voice, some of the, when we're talking about rhythms before, the tonal qualities of the book have been transcribed, you might say, translated into a film mode. And I kind of get a kick out of that. But it's a very different thing, very different experience.
That's nice to hear, though. You so often hear from a reader or a viewer's point of view, well, the book was better. You know, there's no way they could put that book up on the screen. And so it's nice to hear, well, I think the integrity of my book is in this next
stage. Well, I wouldn't say the integrity is, but the integrity didn't need to be to make me happy. The integrity of the book is in the book. Now we're doing something else. When I look, for instance, at a movie like Remains of the Day, which I had read the novel long before I even knew it would be a movie, I can say that I enjoyed both immensely. There are riches to be had in the book having to do with voice and point of view, which could not, because of the genre, because of the nature of the form, be transformed into the movie. On the other hand, the thinginess of movies, the tactile nature of looking at the house and all the details of the building, and being able to see Anthony Hopkins' wonderfully repressed face in that movie, were thrilling to me. So you have to just divide and conquer. I think the old-time notion of violence done, for me anyway, in my work, it's just not a, it just doesn't play a part.
Patricia Hampel with us on Conversations. Let me make another turn. You said something in Virgin Time that fascinated me, and I've kind of been I've been percolating on it. You said something to the effect of Isaac Bashevis Singer said that when he got an idea for a story, the first thing he did was try and figure out whose story it was. You say you look for which questions are yours. For example, in Virgin Time, the question for you was not, is there a God, but what's the place of prayer? Where is contemplation? How did you find that question? And how did you say the question, is there a God, isn't mine? How'd you know this?
Well, you know something. As a writer, you know things when you write it. In other words, all of a sudden you make a statement on paper and you think, yes. And then you have constellated it. Perhaps that constellation in just a few words is the result of a lot of conflicted thinking and non-thinking for a long time. Sometimes you constellate something in words and you simply cross it out. That's called not having constellated it yet. So for me, I would say one thing that I can point to in history besides this dynamic that I've described is a book that I read called An Interrupted Life, a diary by Etty Hillesum. She was sort of a grown-up Anne Frank. She lived in Amsterdam at the same time. She was Jewish. She kept a diary. She was in her 20s, having love affairs and being a graduate student instead of being a young girl. She met the same fate. She underwent a kind of religious, I don't want to say conversion, but a spiritual awakening of some sort, this very worldly, secular, sexy young woman, during the years of the war, just before she was carted away. And she became she became immersed in prayer. And she wrote about the instinct to bend the knee and to bow the head. When I read that, I thought, yes, I've always believed that. I have always believed in the experience of awe. And suddenly, instead of seeing prayer as something that was sort of like a lot of words that you just say, I suddenly thought, that is there. That is a reality. You don't need to say, is there prayer? Yes, we all know that instinct. If you pray, you know it. If you don't pray, you know it. You still wouldn't deny it was there. This was an eye-opener for me. And at that moment, I realized that when that famous old line, scriptural line, the kingdom of God is within you, I thought, what that means is the instinct for prayer, for crying out, is there. And, of course, all my relationship with poetry, which says it has to do with not so much with communication as with utterance itself, which goes out, we don't know where. This seemed to me to be a very significant discovery. I mean personal discovery, which gave me my impulse, my propulsion and trajectory for Virgin Time, which is not just about growing up Catholic, does have those retrospective pieces in it, but it was about what is prayer, why do people pray, why do I pray, and what is prayer?
I must say it's a very, well, I said this at the beginning, this Virgin Time is a very effective book for me because your exploration, much as you say about your grandmother's garden in this other woman's eyes, your exploration becomes my exploration. The whole time I was reading this, I was thinking about the nature of spirituality in my own life, in my culture, because spirituality is complex and fraught in this culture in which I live. And following you through Italy, scrabbling up the hills and down into the valleys and following these people you were following around and looking at them with you. And in all of that, having an opportunity to come back into myself and wonder where that thing you were exploring was in me.
That's the way it's supposed to work. I mean, reading is not a spectator sport. It is a participant sport. And so if that happened, that you were able to scrabble up and down your hills and dales, then that's exactly the job I have. It's not the job I have for myself when I write, but it is the job I have when I publish. Otherwise, why publish? Why not just talk to a pal or think your thoughts? It's a great mystery at the heart of why writing works. Why I can hardly wait to get back to my hotel room to keep reading that novel I started on the airplane. It takes place in the fens of England. Why would I care? I don't know anything about it, but I'm engaged in that life. I need to know not simply what's going to happen next. I need to know what's going to happen next in me as I'm reading that book. It's a sort of magical relationship.
I'm interested that you say it's a mystery.
Oh, I think.
Yeah.
I think so. Very definitely must be a mystery. I mean, there are relationships that there are no other paradigms for. Mother-daughter, mother-child, I guess I should say. Mother-child, lover and beloved. And I think another one of those paradigmatic relationships is writer-reader. It's not like anything else.
Patricia Hample, thank you very much. It's been a very engaged hour.
Thank you.
Let me commend you to these books, Virgin Time, In Search of the Contemplative Life, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, 1992. I found it an excellent read and, as I say, an interesting plum as well. Spillville from Milkweed Editions came out in 1987. This is the study of Dvorak's stay in Spillville, the Iowa farming village, in the summer of 1893. A Romantic Education, A Journey to Patricia Hample's Czechoslovakian Heritage, and more. From Houghton Mifflin, you'll find it in paperback containing a new afterword by the author. It came out in 1992. Patricia Hample has been visiting Fairbanks to give a reading on behalf of the English Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. On this trip to Alaska, she also has visited in Anchorage, University of Alaska Anchorage, and in Southeast. Patricia Hample, teaching at the University of Minnesota and writing for us. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thanks very much. And I hope you join me again next week.